I was very excited to be asked to serve in this position, and even more so when I found out that I was going to be able to host and introduce Katie for this evening. I met Katie about 7 years ago and in a big book study, and you know, we hit it off. There's nothing like finding a peer in life and in sobriety that you just click with, and Katie and I found that. And like I said, it's been an honor to be her host. One of the things that I thought about, Mike, you said it last night, and you were dead on. You know, when Katie walks into the room, it just lights up just from her presence. When I think of Katie, I think of service. I think of selflessness. And I think of total commitment to this program, because that's what she exudes and that's what she represents. And I'm not going to tell her story. She's got a fabulous one. And it is my honor and privilege, with great love and respect, to introduce you to Katie.
Katie, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hey.
And Lynn's got me like crying already. Oh my gosh, there's a whole lot of you. I just want you to know that. I am so indescribably, incredibly honored to be here tonight. I'm so glad, actually, that I'm like a stand-in, because I only found out Wednesday. Because seriously, like, the mental gymnastics that I could have done if I had had a really long time to think about this would be amazing. So I am so grateful to the committee. And they've been, like, so sweet and wonderful, and, like, Tony calling and gushing and saying all these nice things about me. I'm like, oh, Lord, I've got to live up to all that. And such a God thing to have, you know, Lynn be my host. I mean, I was so glad, because I was like, I don't really think I need a host. I'm like, it's the Atlanta Roundup. I'm going to be there the whole weekend anyway. It's like, I'm always at the Atlanta Roundup. It's my place. And that she got to be my, I didn't think I would need a host, but I did. I can tell you that. I did. I did need a host, because I just got to be like, okay, Lynn, can we just go outside and hang out now? And she could tell me to breathe. And I'm so grateful, because, yeah, Lynn's one of those friends, and I've got a few of those friends in this program that I can just, she's a great lady and has a good program, and we can just go sit down and have a cup of coffee, and here's where I'm at, here's where she's at, okay, great, let's keep going, you know? I love that. I'm so, so grateful. I'm also so grateful because, as scary as it is, I have never in my life spoken in front of this many people. But I was telling somebody earlier, it was like, I have home field advantage, you know? Like, that's what I feel like. Because as scary as it is, it's like nothing but an outpouring of love. I mean, from the committee, from my friends, from everybody that I know here, you know, and I had everybody coming up, how are you doing? I'm so excited to hear you. And, you know, and I had people, I just picture everybody naked, which really is just kind of weird. And then I had a few people who offered to come in their underwear, and I was like, no, really, that's cool. It's okay. I'm all right, you know. But I'm, you know, the Atlanta Roundup means so much to me. I haven't missed one since 2000. I started coming to Roundups in 2000, and I haven't missed one because they're always just an outpouring of love, you know. So I'm just, it's absolutely an honor. I mean, when I got that phone call, I mean, what I said, I think, was, I was like, I'm really honored, and I want to throw up at the same time. And that's kind of how it's been. So without any further ado, my story. And that was the other good thing. I was like, you know what, the great thing about, like, getting in front of a bunch of people and telling your story is it's my story. So, like, I can't forget it or anything. I've lived it. But I was born in New York. I know, get a rope. And spent, like, the most of my younger childhood in New York. I was the youngest of three kids. And my parents divorced when I was about 5 years old, and my dad moved down here to Clayton County with his new wife when I was six. So from the time that I was six, I split time between going to school in New York City and living with my mom, and then coming down here in the summer, and then I went to school down here for a couple of years, went there in the summer. So I am like, my accent is so screwed up. Because you will hear very cocky New York-sounding stuff out of me, and then you will hear, like, where the hell did that come from, sickeningly sweet-sounding Southern stuff coming out of my mouth. So I always just warn people ahead of time. Oh, and the other thing that I always like to get out of the way ahead of time so that people aren't sitting there wondering, okay, I'm 37 years old. Anyway, and they're calling me, like, the young speaker this weekend. They're like, we're so glad to have you on because you're, like, the young speaker. And I'm like, I will milk that one as long as I can. Seriously. May 15th, I celebrated 19 years in this program. Which, seriously, after a while, I just feel like I'm getting older. I'm sure, like, there's some wiser in there somewhere, I don't know, but older, definitely. So we got that part out of the way. So I grew up in New York City, in Atlanta, back and forth. I was one of those kids that today would be slapped on Ritalin. I don't think Ritalin was as popular then. I was like an off the wall, all over the place. If my mom turned around and we were in a public place for like 1 second, I was like on the other side of the room doing something. She has some story about like Times Square, walking with me in Times Square. And she said she let go of my hand and turned around. And like the next minute, Times Square was a little different then. She said somebody was pushing me out of a porn shop going like, get out of here, kid. Jeez, I like walked into it. Could have been a hallmark of some trouble. Just into everything. And I was, I think, so socially inept. I was always saying the wrong thing at the wrong time, doing the wrong thing at the wrong time, always getting, like, these strange looks from people, like, what? And I always just give one example just to sum up, to give everybody just a really good idea of what I was like when I was a kid. So here's this one example, and you just have to know that with this one example, there are lots of other things like this. This is just a good choice one. So anyway, fourth, third grade, I think, and I'm in Clayton County, Georgia, going to East Clayton Elementary, and so I'm about 9 years, eight, I don't know, however old you are then. Anyway, so we're like doing this thing called the elephant walk. Our teacher's teaching us this thing called the elephant walk. You just do that kind of stuff in elementary school, which is where she bends over and she swings her arms like this and she's showing us how to do it. It's cute. So she walks right by me, and for some reason, I just think it would be a great idea to slap her ass, and I just do. I don't know. I mean, I didn't really think about it. I just did it. And then, you know, the whole room just turns around like, what? You're like, what do you say to that, you know? And I think she finally just got over her shock enough to be like, to pull me out or something and be like, you just don't do that, you know? It's just inappropriate. Oh, okay, sorry. So, like I said, note to self, lots of other things like that. Always saying and doing the wrong thing at the wrong time. So anyway, that's who I am. And I am also one of those people, like, I'm a firm believer that I was an alcoholic long before I ever picked up a drink. Like, that there was something that was just not right that alcohol made so right. So just being a square peg in a round hole all over the place. I'll tell you this other part of my story, because it was right before I started drinking. I went to a private school in Brooklyn Heights for a couple of years for like fifth and sixth grade, and it was this great private school where all these other kids, we used to talk about things like what were the best Ivy League schools, like really what were the best schools, you know, Harvard or Princeton, you know, or Stanford, like which are the better ones, and you know, does your permanent record really start like in fifth grade or does it start like later on, and we talked about these kind of things. And actually all the kids that I went to school with during that time went on to all those kind of schools. So I went to that school for a couple years. It was great. Then the oil stocks dropped and we had to move back to Manhattan, which is where we lived before on the Upper West Side. And I had to go back to public school. And so I went back to Joan of Arc Junior High School and walked in. And I don't know if any of you guys have ever had this experience, but I walk in and I'm like the only white girl in the whole school. And I was like, okay, this is different. And it's New York, so it's like this mishmash, black, Hispanic, Asian, everything else. I just happen to be the only white girl. So I'm like, all right. So at that school, I proceeded to do what I thought was a totally normal way to handle that kind of social situation, which is that I just kind of started talking in half Spanish and half English and acting like a Puerto Rican. It's what anybody would do, right? Come on. The bottom line is really, like, I would be whatever I needed to be. So what's funny is, so I would go to that school all through the week, and then I still had these friends in Brooklyn on the weekends, and I'd go, you know, take the train, stay there for the weekend, and we'd still talk about those same things. We'd still talk about the schools and everything else, so I would go and do that, and then, you know, all during the week I was a Puerto Rican. I was good at it, though, really, because they'd be like, damn, I don't like those white people, except for you, you're all right. You know, like, that was who I was. So what I remember, though, not long before I had my first drink, was that there was this event that was going to happen. It was like a party or something. And there was going to be my best friend from the private school and my best friend from the public school both in the same place at the same time. Now, fortunately for all concerned, this never happened. But what I remember is this absolute gut-wrenching fear, because I had no idea who I was going to be at that event. Like, what do? You know, it's talk like private school, Puerto Rican, you know, like, what do? I remember that. And let's say I'm 12 years old. I'm 6 feet tall now. Anybody who stood next to me is pretty aware of how tall I am. So I'm like this tall, awkward 12-year-old gangly chick with braces and no boobs and bad hair. And seriously, by this time, like, I needed a drink. And so happily, happily, on New Year's Eve, when I was 12, I had champagne for the first time. And it was like at home, like my grandparents were in town, and we had champagne, and I had had like sips of other stuff before, like wine and beer, and I don't know, but I could never get past that first sip. Like, it was always like, ugh. And champagne, though, I could get past the first sip. And we had these like tall flute glasses, and it was like, before I knew it, I was like, psh, psh, four of them, we're gone. And but that was it, because then we were out, because my parents are non-alcoholics. So we only had like a couple of bottles of champagne for the whole family, which is absolutely ridiculous. But anyway. So I was like just drunk enough that I'm like walking around a little funny. I'm tipsy. And my grandparents, they just think it's cute. And they're like, look, she's tipsy. Isn't it great? And I'm like, and I just remember, a couple of things. I remember one, like, what a great feeling, you know? And two, I remember already at that point, I was disappointed that the bottles were empty, that already I felt like there was further to go here, and I didn't know where it was, but I knew that there was further to go, and I already had that unsatisfied feeling. And it's one of those things that, like, I never really paid that much attention to it when I was drinking, but after I stopped drinking, I remember that every single time that I drank, if I had to leave, if I had to go somewhere, if we ran out, I remember this physically dissatisfied feeling at not being able to finish. And for me, finishing was drinking until I was in blackout or passed out. That was for me finishing. And not every alcoholic drinks like that every single time, but I was one of those. I was, if you gave me a chance. Now, I was also young. So when you're young, people are always telling me, you have to go home now. Come on, we got to go. My dad's with it, whatever. You know, and we ran out a lot because we didn't have that much money. So, but if given the opportunity, every single time I drank, if we had enough and nobody told me to go home, I drank until I passed out or blacked out. So I was just kind of starting to get into all this in New York City, hanging out on the Upper West Side, just starting to drink and just starting to experiment with a few other things too. And it was so funny because it was like all of a sudden I was in on something. I was in on this whole other world that, like, I didn't know I was missing out on until I was in on it, you know? And then all these kids from school who, like, I never really met before and who kind of hung out at the back of the classrooms, if they went to class at all, you know, started coming up to me and being like, hey, what's up, you know? Like, I remember the first time I ever, like, smoked another substance, I had people coming up and, you know, the chick who I was with, they were like, you got the white girl high, man? Like, right on, you know? It was like I was in. And that was totally cool and exciting, and I felt free and out on my own. It was like, oh, you know, finally. It was like, here's this thing that I've been missing, you know. And I fell in love with the whole thing. Then my mom, like, so I'm like the city kid, right? Then my mom, like, drops this bomb on us that, like, we're moving to Granville, Ohio. So I'm going to start my 9th grade year moving from New York City to Granville, Ohio, which is, like, population 5,000 at the time. But at the same time, I'm kind of excited because, like, I always hit this point at every school. Like, I never spent longer than 2.5 years at any school. Like, that was the longest I ever spent. And it seems like, oh, gosh, you didn't really get to spend that long. I was usually ready. Like, by the time I was leaving the school, I was usually ready because I was like, thank God I can start over, you know? And then, of course, after a couple more years, I was, like, ready to leave the next one. Like, okay, I can start over again. So I kind of had a little bit of that. And it was cute. Like, I never lived in a small town because even when we were out in Clayton County, it wasn't a small town. It was just rural, suburban Atlanta, you know? It was different. And this is a cute little small town, and they had, like, football teams and cheerleaders, and I never experienced any of that before. But what they also had that was great was they had this university there called Denison University. And the Barron's Book of Colleges once described Denison University as the best academic party school in America. So what that means is all these kids who were, like, usually from, like, the Northeast, all the ones that couldn't get into Ivy League schools because they partied a little bit too much, they went there. So now by this time, my behavior had changed already in New York, and I was already, like, staying out later than I was supposed to. I had already figured out that, like, going to Central Park in the afternoon was much better than going to class in the afternoon. I had already started doing all that kind of stuff. I had started stealing from my parents. I had started, a whole slew of behavioral issues. It's already lying. All that stuff. So my mom, once we moved to Ohio, we're all in fresh start mode. You know, I'm like in a fresh start. And, you know, I think I'm grounded most of that first year. Anyway, so she starts employing like all of these different techniques like contracts. Some of you guys did contracts. We did those where you sign and put them on the fridge about like not drinking or whatever you're going to do. I don't know. And then usually with me, they were behavior contracts. And then everybody forgets about them once they're on the fridge. And then you just like take them down after a while because you know damn well that nobody's living by them and they're just embarrassing. So I think eventually my mom would just throw them away. We started going to therapy. I had a therapist named Suzanne, and I thought Suzanne was great, you know, because I'd go in and talk to her once a week, and she'd have me do cute stuff like draw pictures of, I don't know, flowers and houses and families and stuff. And we'd talk, and it was I could bitch about my mom for an hour because that's what it was. So I would go in, and I would just complain for an hour and then be done. And I don't even think she ever asked me if I drank or not. I don't think she did. But anyway, not like I would have been that honest if she had. So anyway, my mom's already starting to employ some control, and I'm grounded a lot. So I learned how to sneak out, you know, because now we're not up in like an apartment. Like, it's easy to sneak out of a house. So I start sneaking out and going to the university at night and then coming back in and periodically getting busted. And then I was still coming down here to Atlanta in the summertime. So anyway, we'll fast forward to my junior year. By the time my junior year rolled around, I'd spent a lot of time down here in Atlanta. I don't know. Anyway, somewhere in there, like, my hair's black. It's shaved all around the sides. My roots are usually, like, purple or something else, and I'm wearing all black, and I'm, like, got a white face and black eyeliner out to here, because it was the 80s. And actually, in a small town, like, it's not like that anymore, I think, because of MTV. But anyway, like, back then, it was really cool because nobody looked like that in Ohio, you know? Like, down here in Atlanta, like, it wasn't all that unusual, but, like, I'd go to Ohio, and I'd go to, like, the next town because it's, you know, small towns, and they'd be like, you're that girl from Granville. And I was like, yeah. Loved it. And then what was great about that whole scene, too, was if you didn't like me, that was why. It was just because you were so unaccepting and so conformist. That was why you didn't like me. I wasn't responsible. So anyway, everything proceeded to get worse, blah, blah, blah. I think we all know this story. I go sneak out of the house one night, 16, and I go to the college like I usually did to the dorms. And I guess that night, like, it was one of those nights where nobody told me to go home and nobody told me that I had to quit drinking and we didn't run out. So, you know, I wake up and it's like 10 a.m. and I'm, you know, sleeping on the floor in the dorm. And I wake up to somebody running down the hallway yelling, if anybody knows where Katie Thornberry is, tell her mom's looking for her and she needs to come home now. My mom was a professor at this university, by the way. Forgot to mention that. So the two guys whose dorm floor I'm asleep on are looking at me, the 16-year-old passed out, and going like, you need to get out of here. So I take the long walk home, and I'm, like, formulating a story, you know, because I've always got to formulate a story. And I'll tell my mom I went to Saturday school, because I'm realizing it's a Saturday and I had missed Saturday school because I spent a lot of time in Saturday school. Anyway, so I'd missed that. I'd blown that too. So I was like, I'll just tell her I got up early and went to Saturday school. I had this whole thing. And then I walk in the house and I'm like, Mom, I just got up early and went to Saturday school, but I heard you were looking for... And she's like, we already called Saturday school. And she was all quiet, you know? And then she's like, have a seat. You have two options. You can either, one, live independently, which basically meant just go get out. Or two, you can go, I've talked to your father in Atlanta, and you can go and live with your father in Atlanta. He's willing to take you. Okay, I'll take option two. I mean, because I'm 16 in Ohio. It's like, I don't know anybody who lives on their own in Ohio. I know college students who live in dorms and people with parents, you know. That's all I know there. So, and Atlanta wasn't, you know, I liked Atlanta. It was cool. And my dad was newly divorced for the second time. And I didn't realize, it, like, when I was going down there, how useful that was going to be. But I got down. And, you know, and I got down, and my dad, you know, sat me down, and we had that talk, you know, like, we're not going to have any of that business like you did at your mom's, and blah, 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 blah. That's about how I heard it. And I'm like, oh, yeah, Dad, no, yeah, no way, yeah, no, it's not going to happen. So anyway, so, like, a few days later is New Year's Eve, and of course, I tell my dad I'm going somewhere else, because this is actually how I got away with that whole drinking till I passed out thing a lot, is I was always staying at somebody's house, and then I would just say that I was going to stay at somebody's house, and then I didn't even necessarily know where I was going to end up. I just knew that as long as I said I was staying at somebody's house, I could drink the way that I wanted to drink, and as long as I ended up somewhere, that was fine. This is normal, I think, right? I seriously, I had no idea that any of this was drinking abnormally. I didn't realize that, like, planning for the fact that I was going to drink to blackout was weird in any way, shape, or form. So anyway, so for this, I didn't really plan that well, because I told my dad I was going to be somewhere else, but he wasn't going to let me spend the night. He was like, no, you got to be back by, like, something really lenient. It was like 4 a.m. or something, you know? You know, something really good. So, of course, I go out. And I drink, and nobody tells me to go home, and nobody stops me. And once again, I wake up, and I have no idea where I am. I'm like, okay, no idea where I am. All right. Start walking around the house, and I'm like, and I'm formulating my plan again, you know, because I got a plan. So I'm like, okay, I gotta call my dad. All right, I call my dad. I'm telling him I fell asleep at my friend Sony's house, and we're good. Okay. So I pick up the phone and call my dad, and I'm like, Dad, yeah, I fell asleep at Sony's house. I already called Sony's house. You know? And then he's like, where are you? And then I'm like, oh, shoot. I don't remember where I am. I don't know where I am. And I'm like, hold on. So I'm like looking around the house, and there's this one chick in the house. I'm like all hungover like this. She's coked up. She's, like, been up all night. I don't know who she is, but she's like, blah, 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 you know? So I'm like, where am I? And she tries to tell me, and she's like, blah, 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 blah. And I just can't understand her because I'm hungover. And I'm like, hold on, Dad. So I put my dad on the phone with the coked out girl. So she couldn't work. So then she hands the phone back to me. I'll be there in 10 minutes. Okay. So anyway, I know I'm, like, in for it. I mean, there had been murmurs about, like, military school my mom had discussed. I mean, so I'm not sure what I'm in for now, you know. I'm scared to death, and so my dad comes, and then the car, like, pulls forward 6 feet, and I'm like, stop, because I have to open the door and throw up. And, so anyway, he doesn't even say a word the whole drive home, and then, you know, we get home, and he just says, go to sleep. Okay, so I go to sleep. And then we get up, and, you know, he's ready to have the talk. You know, blah, 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 disappointed, blah, 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 blah. You're grounded for a week. Really? All right. And then after like 5 days, he was kind of sick of seeing me around the house, and he let me go out with my brother, and I was like, okay, guilt-ridden father, me getting loaded, this is awesome, you know? Like, I can use this to my fullest advantage. And so I did. And really, sadly enough for my father, like, I put him through a lot in that next year and a half, because I thought Atlanta was fantastic. I mean, I loved Little Five Points. I fell in love. That was like my home away from home, because I could be so cool there with my little black hair and wearing all black and my shaved head. And I just loved, no, once again, I loved the lifestyle. It was like I had friends who lived like 10 people in one apartment and just like got loaded all the time. And I thought it was so great. It was like the best place ever, you know. And once again, I could tell my dad, like, I'm staying at this person's house or this person's house, and I would just go down there and end up somewhere, just end up staying somewhere, you know. So it was kind of like being a little runaway chick, but on my terms, you know, like when I wanted to. And I thought that was great. And I was going to school and not doing very well. In fact, then I went to a school called Open Campus, DeKalb. Some of you guys are probably familiar with that. That's where they send all the people who aren't doing that well in regular school. Because I was going to Towers for like 6 months, and they were like, maybe you'd feel more comfortable at Open Campus. All right, you know. And I thought Open Campus was great because everybody there was like me. Well, okay, most of them were like me. Some of them, like my future husband, who I didn't even know was going to school there, was actually like staying sober and one of those people that actually went to class and then just left. I don't know. I was not like that. So anyway, the cool thing about Open Campus was they had like 6 week quarters and 2 hour classes, and you were responsible for your own absences, you know, because you're a responsible student and you can be responsible for those absences. So I would end up just dropping classes all the time, because if you missed more than 3 full days of a class, they just dropped you. Natural consequences, right? So by the end, I was basically just pretending to go to school every day. And I would leave the house, bye, Dad, going to school. And then I would just go hang out because I didn't have any classes to go to. And hanging out in Little Five Points. And, you know, it was so funny. Like later on, like after I sobered up, because these kind of things didn't occur to me before I sobered up, I thought it was so funny because I... Like, remember the Ivy League conversations that I was having when I was younger? Like, I was for real about those. Like, I was totally in to, like, going to some Ivy League school and being, like, some hotshot, like, lawyer, doctor, something like that. And both my parents are really well-educated. Like, both my parents have PhDs, you know. And that was totally realistic to me. And then, like, when I started partying, it was like suddenly... Well, state school's not really so bad. They're great schools. State schools, not so bad. You don't have to work that hard to get into them. And then it was like, well, maybe community college is good, you know. And then it's like, you know, maybe I'll just take a year off or so after I get out of high school. And so by the time I'm like, you know, towards the end, I was like, I was, when I came in, I was 3 months away from being 18 years old. And my big dream at the time was I could not wait until I turned 18, because when I turned 18, I could quit school and get a job at the Point in Little Five Points, because then you could serve alcohol, and I could get a job at the Point and make just enough money to, like, just hang out in an apartment with 10 people and get loaded all the time. That was, like, whew, big dream, you know? And I never saw that happen, you know? Like, I never saw how that went and how everything had changed, but there it was. But I made my dad's life miserable those last couple of years, and partly because I knew he was so guilty, and partly because when my mom kicked me out before, I didn't know anybody that lived on their own, but now I, like, knew all these people, and I kind of wanted to get kicked out. Because, you know, that whole scene, you can't really just leave home, you know, unless you have a good reason, like somebody's molesting you or something, you know. You don't have a good reason to leave home where you have, like, a perfectly good refrigerator with food in it and all that kind of stuff, and then just go down there, because they'll be like, what the hell are you doing down here with us, you know? But if I got kicked out... then I could go down there and live with all those guys and be cool. So it was like the safety net. It was like, well, what's the worst thing my dad's going to do? Kick me out? Good. I would try to get kicked out. And he just wouldn't do it. I mean, seriously, God bless my dad in that last year and a half. And I didn't realize how much I put him through until after. I guess none of us really do, you know. And like when I was making amends to my dad, like probably like 9 months or a year later, I remember him saying, you know, there were times when I really thought that you might die or that I might die because I couldn't take it anymore. And I was like, really? You know, I really didn't realize what I was doing to him. And he had friends that were just begging to put me in treatment, and he just couldn't pull the trigger. He kept going, you know what, she'll get it, you know. And I think he was just scared that if he did anything that I would just split and he would lose me forever. And maybe he would have been right, you know, because I'd have split and gone to Little Five Points. Who knows? I don't know. I figure everything lines up the way that it needs to. So the way that it needed to line up for me to get into this program was a guy. I like fell in love in this really dramatic way, like we all do when we're teenagers, and started dating this guy named Tim, and he was like kind of messed up, you know. And I thought, okay, so his parents put him in treatment in like October 1988, and I was like, okay, good, because he needs to go, you know, he's really messed up, so that's good for him. And it was my first round of like, and I'll stay sober for you. You know, because I'd never really tried to stay sober before, you know. I just was like, I'm going to be supportive, and I'll stay sober for you, baby. And then that lasted only a few days, and then I realized, like, well, if I just drink and don't tell him, then it's like the same thing. It's still being supportive, because what does he know, you know? So that started kind of in and out periods of trying to control it and then not trying to control it and kind of going back and forth. And that was also not long after that that I went to my first AA meeting. And because he'd gotten out of treatment and, you know, he's supposed to go to meetings. And it was at the Triangle Club, back when they had it in the just the little house part. And I remember that it was all, like, smoking on one side and non-smoking on the other. And it just didn't matter because, like, the whole thing was filled with smoke, which I thought was great. Because I could just smoke and hang out and drink coffee. But anyway, so I go to this one meeting. And I'm sure we got there like right at 8 o'clock, and I just sat in the back. And what you guys were doing had nothing to do with me, as far as I was concerned. I was just hanging out in this meeting. I did not raise my hand as a newcomer. I did not pick up a white chip, because all I saw when I walked in was just a sea of old people. I mean, I was 17 years old. Seriously, I saw a sea of old people. It was 1988, and I'm sure there were actually some kind of younger people in the room. I'm sure, but all I saw was that everybody was older than me. And I thought it was really nice and really cute that you old alcoholics had this place that you went where you could talk about stuff. Like, that was really cool. It just did not have anything to do with me. And at the time, I really didn't think that I was one of you anyway. Now, my boyfriend was bringing me along because he was pretty sure that I was, but I wasn't really all that clued into that at the time. So anyway, so I proceed to do this whole, like, you know, drink, not drink, drink, not drink. And it was so funny because I would never, like, it wasn't like I ever couldn't stay sober, but, like, I would just change my mind, you know, like a few days in. I would not drink for, okay, I'm just going to not drink. And then I'd be like, well, obviously, I haven't drank for a few days, so this is not an issue. Let's drink, you know. So it's so funny. What's funny about that is just that I never realized that it was powerlessness. You know, I never realized it was that I couldn't not drink because I was changing my mind every single time. Now, I have a feeling if I had continued to do that for a lot longer, it would have felt a lot less like changing my mind because that's what I hear you guys talk about. So that's what I know that I would have to look forward to if I went back out again. So since I couldn't get past the old people thing, what was kind of cool was that my boyfriend ended up going to this outpatient program that was this young people's program that had, like, their own meetings and stuff. And once he had around 3 months or so, he didn't say that he was going to break up with me if I didn't get sober, because technically I was sober. I had been sober for 4 months as far as he was concerned. So he didn't say that. But he said, you know, I'm really not going to get to see you that much now that I'm getting so much more involved over here unless you start going to some meetings. That was how he put it. And I knew what he meant. I knew what he meant was, you know, something's got to change or we ain't going to last. So for a guy, I came to a meeting at this place. And this was a little different, you know, because it was like young people all over the place and they're bouncing all over the walls. And they were like my age and a little younger, a little older. And I remember sitting down with this kid at my first meeting. He's probably like 15 years old, 15, 16. And I was kind of like, what are you in for, you know? So he was telling me like a little bit of his history. And I'm like, he doesn't belong here. I got loaded more than he did. You know, like that's what I thought. But there was something about that place that I could see. It's like I could see past the old age. Seriously, I did not dig AA meetings until I had a year sober. Like, I went to these other meetings and AA meetings, not liking the AA meetings so much, for like a year, and then it was like right about a year sober that I started to realize that they were talking about the same thing. That the same thing that you people were talking about were the same things that we were talking about. And then I was like, oh. It's like somehow I could hear it. But it took a year. So I'm really grateful that this thing was in place. And I know that there was Young People's AA back then, but I hadn't found it. I hadn't stumbled across it. So I was grateful that I landed where I did. I mean, I always think that everything happens for a reason, including this boyfriend. Because seriously, if it hadn't been for a guy, there is no way I was walking into this program when I did. So I start coming to meetings, and I'm lying, of course, because I already have my 4 months sober, as I tell all of you. But I could see the light in people's eyes, and I could get that thing. I don't know, that thing when like we fall in love with this program, that thing that we see, that light, that feeling, that sense, and that growing tiredness with what I was doing and knowing that something wasn't right, but I didn't know what it was. I mean, I still thought it was everything else. I mean, I thought the reason that school wasn't working out was because, I don't know, they just couldn't facilitate having someone as gifted as me there because they didn't challenge me enough. I mean, I had reasons for, like, everything. But I knew something wasn't right. I just had no idea that it had anything to do with me getting loaded. So I came around just because it was interesting and it was fun and these people were cool. And then I started having talks. I started having talks with people, which is very dangerous. And I remember this one guy in particular talking about what alcoholism is. And he was talking about the doctor's opinion and the progression of the disease. And doesn't mean we have to drink, you know, all the time, every day, but that once we start, all bets are off. You know, there's no telling. And it was the first time I realized that not everybody drank like that. And he didn't hand me the big book and tell me to read it. He explained the things that were in that book in a way that I could understand. And so I started to think about, at least intellectually, that maybe, just maybe, it might be the alcohol. So I was willing to listen and stick around. But I still, like, people told me to get a sponsor, and I got one that I never called, you know. And I went to meetings, and they did stuff after. I mean, this was the other thing that was great, was, like, they would go and, like, hang out after the meetings, like, all these different, you know, kids and do stuff. And we'd go to, like, Denny's. I mean, a lot. You know what's funny is, like, all the other, like, AAs and young people, I think, went there at the same time, too. You remember the Denny's that used to be on 285? We call it Twilight Zone Denny's. Awesome place. We'd stay there till like 4 in the morning doing absolutely nothing. But it was great. Like, whatever it was that was going on, it was, like, fantastic. And I hung around, and enough to see and enough to learn and enough to at least logically get that I might be an alcoholic. But I didn't get that I really needed you guys to quit drinking. But I had stopped. I mean, since I came in, since I, you know, came to that first meeting, I had stopped drinking. And by the time I had 30 days, I had decided that I should just go ahead and be honest. And that was like the first scary, really scary thing that I had to walk through, was because I was sure you guys were going to like hate me and push me out the door as soon as I said, like, okay, like now I have 30 days. I really didn't have those 4 months. And it was really funny because everybody was like, oh yeah, like, I had just had the impression that they already knew that. I don't know how. But I had been honest. But I hadn't done a lot. I hadn't embraced the steps. And I was so opposed to anything having to do with God. I was a staunch atheist for a long time. And then I decided that, like, that was so ignorant. It was equally as ignorant as believing. So I had decided that I was agnostic long before I ever came in these rooms. In fact, I was so impressed that you guys had a chapter called We Agnostics, because I was like, that's great, they know my word. Because I was like 16 or 17, you know. So, like, kids my age, I'd be like, I'm agnostic. And they'd be like, what does that mean? Let me explain. So I was so impressed that you guys knew that word. But, I mean, I had just over-intellectualized God, tried to figure out God, and just decided that, you know, that God didn't exist. And so I was scared by all that, and I was very opposed to all that, and fought it. And I would try to get people to argue. I was one of those people. I was like that when I was getting loaded, too. I would, like, love to get a hold of a Christian and argue and, like, suck them into, like, a whole thing and have them get real defensive and flustered, and I loved it. So I tried to do that with the people in these rooms, and it did not work very well, which was, like, so impressive and disarming at the same time. And what was great was you guys said, like, okay, cool, keep coming back. I mean, that was pretty much what everybody said, you know, or they just said, that's cool, I believe. So I hit about 4 months sober, dry, whatever, and I'd been hanging out. And now remember, I'm like one of those people, I totally believe that I was an alcoholic before I ever picked up a drink. So drinking was like the best thing I ever found. That was my solution. That was my answer. So I had just taken away my solution for 4 months. And I hit that point that a lot of us hit where, like, I'm just about to crawl out of my skin. And I hit the point where either I'm going to drink or I'm going to start doing something. And I'm, like, sitting in my driveway talking to somebody. And all I remember is just that I'm curled up in a little ball and I'm crying. And I'm like, I just want to go home. I just want to go home. And that's all I can say is I just want to go home. And I'm sitting in my driveway. But that was like, those were like the only words that I knew to put on it was I want to go home. And that was when I got willing. And because I knew that everybody who had that light in their eyes and was like great and jumping around the room being all happy and skippy and stuff, that they all had some kind of a power greater than themselves that they believed in. And I hit that point where I was willing. And at this point, I had also read We Agnostics, which I thought was so disarming. That was such a great chapter for me. It really was. And it was funny, that was the first chapter I ever read in the big book. I didn't read any of the other stuff. They just said, great, there's a chapter in here for you. Why don't you read it? Okay. Since I love that word so much. But I read it. It was so great because it just backdoored, you know, every argument that I ever had. It just backdoored it. And so here I was finally humbled and in a place where I was just willing to believe that you guys had something that I didn't. And I was just so scared. I didn't know where to start. I was like, but I don't believe in this, and I don't believe in this. And I thought that I had to, like, pick something, you know? Like, I thought I had to pick. Am I going to be a Muslim? Am I going to be a Christian? Am I going to be this? Am I going to be Baptist? Am I what? What am I? You know, and I had a problem with all of those because there were things that I didn't believe about this, 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 and this. And my sponsor was great. She was like, quit worrying about what you don't believe in and just worry about what you do believe in, which was almost nothing. I was like, that's almost nothing. And she was like, great, fine, good start. But that was like one of the best things she could have ever said. And then she told me to start praying and hit my knees. You know, I was like, okay. And I was totally grudging about it. And I was like, great, you know, and I go home and I'd like close the door so my father, the minister, couldn't see me pray. Heaven forbid. I didn't mention that he was a minister, did I? Yeah. And I'm like on my knees because that's what she said, you know. And I'm like, and I just feel like I'm talking to the air, you know. I'm like, this is so not profound. And I'm just on my knees feeling like a dork going, all right, whatever you are, I need to get to know you here. And that was it. You know, that was really about it. That was like the extent of my first prayer. And but I continued to do that. And what I think now, looking back, what I think is so interesting about that is that felt like the least profound, most stupid, I'm just doing this because I'm willing kind of thing to do. I mean, there was no sense of God when I hit my knees. It just felt like nothing. It felt like nothing, air, that's it. Okay, great, I'm talking to myself as far as I'm concerned. But the longer that I did that, it was when everything started to change, you know? And I just think it's interesting that the things that I think are like so amazingly profound in my life are really not always that profound. And the things that I think are just so stupid and trivial are the things that absolutely change my life. You know, like take service work, for example, you know, like because I remember cleaning out ashtrays back when we actually smoked in meetings. I remember doing stuff like that and thinking that it was stupid to get there early and stay late and, you know, stick my hand out and all that kind of stuff. I mean, I thought that was all so lame, but that all began to shape me being a part of all of this. And I had no idea the impact that it was doing when I was doing it. I was just doing it because finally I hit a place where I knew that whatever I was doing wasn't working, and so therefore I'd better listen to you guys because it was better than nothing. So that continued. So I ended up finally working the steps, working a first step, going through all the steps, writing an inventory, being as honest as I humanly could, going through, making amends to my parents, and began to just get a taste of what this program is about, and just fell in love with recovery. And I was so glad that I sobered up around the group of people that I did, because they really instilled in me an excitement for, like, just finding out what's out there, you know? The excitement of being sober and what that brings, you know, like that kind of enthusiasm for just living, you know, like what's great about living by principles, because I have more fun when I live by principles, because I don't have this crap in the back of my head worrying about what I said to so-and-so and, you know, if this person knew about this thing, like the kind of stuff that was going on in my head shortly before I had a drink, you know, but that being honest and upfront and all that and trusting God just brings me to a place that is an adventure that's like fantastic and wonderful. And what a cool thing to have instilled in me. Because I have held on to that this whole time. And even when things get scary and rough, it's like that's that place that I come back to. That and that first step, you know. I got that first step then, and I think like everything in this program, I get everything in layers, you know. Like I had that first step then, and I think it's become more solidified over time. Like I know a lot of people in this room I've heard talk about like the second half of the first step and how that's probably the hardest to get, you know, or at least being sober. That's the hardest to get because I still want to think that I can run the show. And then it's like, oh, you know, what's great? Like today, I do not trust my decision-making process unless I'm willing to share it with anybody else. I don't trust it. It was funny. I was in a meeting about trust like a couple of weeks ago, and people were talking about fears about trusting people and all that kind of stuff and, you know, being vulnerable. And I was like, you know what's great is I'm way more scared to keep stuff to myself than I am to share it with you, because seriously, there is nothing that you could do that would be any worse than me keeping stuff to myself. Seriously. So like if I tell somebody something, not that it would be great for somebody to go and like spread it all over the world if I shared some like intimate secret with somebody or my sponsor or like if somebody read my fourth step today, I would not be happy, skippy, and jumping, but I would be in a much better place than if I didn't put stuff on that fourth step in the first place, you know? I know not to trust me. And I learned that over time. Just like, you know, my definition of honesty changes all the time. And I think that is so cool, you know, that my definition of honesty when I came in was very skewed, because it was like, unless you asked a direct question, you know, it was like I wasn't being dishonest. And obviously that changed, you know, over time. And that's cool, you know, and I feel like all the time, just like that syndrome of, you know, opening up the big book and finding some passage that I swear has never been there before, you know. I think that's great. That is the coolest thing about this program, is as I continue to grow and change, stuff gets better and there's always more to learn, you know. I always talk about how, like, I love picking up chips and thinking about how I was so in such a bad place the year before. Like, how could I have been so screwed up the year before, because now it's so awesome, you know. God, I was so messed up then. I'm so much better now. Like, that's what it feels like. But I'm like, what's great about that is that means every year, like, it gets better. Every year, I learn more stuff. Every year, I'm like, oh, that's honesty? Oh, okay. You know? I think that's awesome. You know, and that's what keeps meetings alive for me. Like, I go into meetings. Like, this huge red flag for me is if I'm starting to get that sense when I'm going to meetings, like I've heard it all before, like, okay, great, I'm hearing all the same stuff over and over again, I've heard it all before, that it's not the meetings. Because seriously, they're saying the same stuff in meetings now that they were saying like 19 years ago when I came in, that they've been saying the whole frickin' time. It's all the same stuff. So when I think I've heard it all and I'm just hearing the same stuff, it means that I'm not changing and growing. You know, because when I'm changing and growing, I hear the stuff that you guys say differently. Like, you guys are talking about the third step, turning your will and your life over to the care of God. If I've got some whole new area of my life that I'm just really kind of figuring out how to turn that over, I hear that in a meeting so much differently. And like, oh my God, really? You know, so I always learn because I'm growing and changing, you know. So if I stop doing that, you know, it's a red flag. Like, if I start feeling bored in meetings, that's a red flag that I'm not doing something right. So anyway, so I had gone to work for this program. I ended up working for this program, ended up moving to Texas and went through training, and I got my, like, license and all that stuff to be, like, a CADC. Remember those? I think they probably still have them. And was working for this program, and I got married. And I got married for not a very good reason to get married. And it was that I sort of hit this point in my life where I didn't know what I wanted to do with my life. So I was like, I'll get married. I was so scared, you know, to be responsible for my own life. And it wasn't like the guy that I was dating at the time was, like, bad or anything, because he would have been a fantastic relationship. He really would have been a great relationship. But I was scared, and I didn't know what to do with my life. And so it seemed like that was a good, natural next step. So I got married, and lived in Texas in San Antonio for a while, lived in Phoenix for a little while, lived in Colorado for a little while, and that was fun, moving around in my 20s, because that was like an adventure. And went through, I hit a point when I moved back here. I moved back to Atlanta in 1997, and hit a point that was, I had been kind of wondering, like, maybe I shouldn't be married, I don't know, for a few years. And I'd started talking about it probably like 4 years into the marriage. And what was kind of good about this whole process was, as soon as I started raising the question, it was like, okay, is your own house in order? Because that's where I always have to look first. And that's what you guys have always taught me, is my own house clean? I love this, by the way. Trust God, clean house, help others. How cool and simple is that? So this was like, okay, I need to make sure my own house is in order. And it wasn't quite in order. I had a lot of defects and stuff and things to work on. And I had to, like, I spent the next couple years not making a decision about whether or not I was going to stay married or not, and just cleaning house. And then once we'd hit almost the 7-year mark, I had done a lot of praying and a lot of talking. And it's one of those sticky situations where you guys can't tell me what to do, you know, which I almost hate, because I really want you guys to tell me what to do, because then you're responsible and I can tell you to piss off if it doesn't turn out the way that I want it to. So anyway, it was a decision that was really hard that I had to come to between me and God, and I had to make sure my own house was clean. And what was good was, it was a good exercise for me in learning how to make that kind of decision. So I finally hit a point at almost 7 years when it was like, you know what, this is not the person that I want to spend the rest of my life with, and this isn't fair. So I got to end it. And it was a scary thing, but it was good. So I did that, and then following that was an awful lot of change. It was probably about 9 months later. I'd moved out, and I was living with some girls, which was really good and really fun. And I was still working for this program, and I kept hitting like this ceiling, you know, like this little glass ceiling. It felt like I always, just in my own personal growth, I always felt like I would get to this certain point and I just couldn't get past it. And I knew that it had something to do with that place between me and God. I just knew it had something to do with my relationship with God, because it seemed like other people could trust in areas where I couldn't. And it was like people would ask me to make decisions, or, hey, how are you? And I would look to the side and go, how am I, you know? I was missing something. And I started praying. That's right. This is where you guys have to be very careful. I started praying to God to remove anything that stood between me and him. Be very careful with that prayer. Because then I proceeded to have removed from my life just about everything that was comfortable to me. I got fired from the program that I worked for. And it wasn't like this big grand thing that I got fired for, but it was just one of these, like, you know what, like, something's not right, and you're done here, you know? Because I think everybody else knew that same thing. Like, there was a ceiling I couldn't push past, you know? And I can't look to you guys to tell me if I'm okay. Like, if I'm going to be, like, a grown-up sober person, eventually I've got to get to the place where, between me and God, I like what I'm doing and what I'm saying, you know? Like, that's different. It's a lot different. And for some reason, it was like having training wheels. Like, I just was not going to ride that dang bike without the training wheels as long as they were there. So I think this was God's help to just kind of push me out a little bit. Thanks a lot, God. And I moved out by myself for the first time, because I'd lived with girls. I'd never lived by myself before. And I ended up stumbling onto this job at an architectural firm, which I thought was like just going to be the job that like I keep for a little while. 7 years later, I'm still there. Love my job. It's great. And just thrust in this whole new world. My two best friends moved away that year. It was like slowly anything that felt safe and normal to me was gone. And because I wasn't working at the same place and I got this job at Perimeter, I had this like kind of nice, cozy little home group that I used to go to, the women's meeting at Easy 123. I saw some women here tonight from there too. It's great. I always see them at the Roundup. That was my nice little safe AA meeting that I used to go to. So I couldn't really go to that anymore. And now suddenly I'm like, okay, what's near here? All right, 8111, the Rule 62 group I stumbled into. And I met this girl, Candy, who was just bubbly love. I don't know if anyone in this room knows Candy. She's like nothing but bubbly love. And she's like, hey, how are you? And she was like so excited. And so like my whole world has just fallen apart. Like I've been fired. I'm like moving out on my own. Everything has changed. I'm at a whole new job. And I don't know what to do with myself. And what's kind of weird is I've never really had to make AA my home. I was sitting there with like 10 years sober, and it was like working for this other program. It was like I sponsored people over there. I went to their meetings, and I always went to AA meetings, but it was like I could never get that involved because like all my kind of service mentality commitments and stuff were over here. So at 10 years sober, I'm hanging out going, I have no idea what a GSR is, you know? What's a DCM? What is all this stuff? Like, I don't know. You know, I've been to some group conscience meetings, I remember, in Texas, and I'd been, like, kind of minimally, peripherally involved in, like, Texipa and stuff like that when I lived there. But, like, I didn't know a whole lot about any of that stuff. So I really had to jump into a whole new home group and really make AA my home in a whole different way. And I knew that the way that I needed to do that was to begin to be of service and, like, with a quickness. So I think it wasn't long that they needed a group secretary, and I signed up to be secretary, I signed up to chair meetings, and I was such a wreck, you guys, because seriously, my life had just changed so dramatically that I was a wreck. I mean, I remember picking up my 11-year chip at this clubhouse, and it was only like a couple months after I'd been fired, and I'm just like, it felt like a dubious honor to have 11 years, you know, because I did not feel like I had 11 years. I felt like a newcomer. And I got this sponsor. This sponsor, Barb, who was so good for me, because I had read a lot of the big book, the 12 and 12, all the literature. I knew it really well by then. I hadn't been real involved in service, but I always had, you know, I'd read, you know, all the literature I'd been way into. So I'm like, all the stuff's gone down. I like have this whole new life, this whole new home group. I just got a new sponsor, and I'm like, okay, can we get going? And steps in the book, and da 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 da. Can we get in here? And da da da. And I started reading this, 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 and this, and I'm doing this, da 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 da. And she was like, whoa, 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 whoa. Because everything in my life had just changed. And she was like, and I've never heard a sponsor tell anybody else this, ever. But she was like, why don't you put your big book away for a little while? Never heard that before. She's like, just take your big book and your 12 and 12, just put them under your bed. They're right there. She's like, but for the next couple months, why don't you just go to meetings? Be a part of the fellowship. Talk to me. You live a first, second, and third step with everything that's going on right now. She's like, live it. She's like, you want to go here. Because I did. I wanted to go here to my brain because it was safe. You know, I wanted to intellectualize, figure out the answer. I wanted there to be an answer. There wasn't an answer. I wanted to just do this one right thing. Or maybe there was this thing that, like, I hadn't been honest about and I just don't remember. And if I'm honest about it, then it's all going to make it better. I'm sure there's people who understand that in here. You know, I wanted there to be that one thing, and it was like there wasn't this one thing. It was like I had to go through this process, you know, and I had to do it with an open heart and just walk through it and be there and be present and trust God. And I did, and that was like the hardest year and a half that I have ever spent. Like, I had a knot in my stomach of just fear that did not go away, I swear to God, for like 6 months. Because I didn't know how to trust God like that. But suddenly it was like all my training wheels were gone and I had no choice but to trust God. And I'm so grateful that all that happened. And what was funny was at the time it was like I knew that there was going to be this point. And I used to make fun and be like, and I'm sure there's some point where I'm going to be so grateful that all this happened the way that it did. Because that's how it always goes. You know? But when I was searching for the answers, it was really funny. My sponsor said something. Oh, okay. I was telling her. I was like, you know, because everybody would give me these Zen answers about what's going on, these really spiritual sounding answers. And I'd be like, you know, I feel like I'm in the Wizard of Oz, like I'm Dorothy, and like I know how to get home, but I just can't, you know. And she was like, you know what? That's a lot more true than you think it is. And I really didn't get what she meant because that sounded like more of that Zen crap. But what I was willing to trust was that there would be a time when it would make sense to me. And I got like this little magnet of the ruby slippers, and I put it on my refrigerator because that was just, I wanted to trust that there was going to be a point where I could click my heels and go home, you know, and that there was a point and I would have to go through it, and it wasn't something that you guys could tell me. It wasn't an answer you guys could just give me. I was just going to have to go through it. And during that year and a half, that was where I found that place between me and God. That was where I grew into that. And so while it was so tough, I'm so grateful. And it wasn't like one day it all clicked and I could really click my heels and go home or whatever. But it was like gradually I started to notice, you know. Gradually I realized that I was more at peace with myself. Gradually I started to realize that I knew when I was okay or not, you know. And not like I didn't need to have sponsorship, because of course I do. And of course I need to go to meetings and make sure I know, like, you know, where I'm at. You know, I walk into a meeting and that's how I find out, you know, whatever it is, what condition my condition's in. But I knew. You know, I've got this place now that I know. I know what trusting my gut really feels like today. And I don't think I would have that without that experience. And for that, I'm really, really grateful. And so all that just opened up a whole world of new experiences. And with service as a foundation, service is a great foundation only because I learn a lot about myself in service. No idea that I was really that controlling. But ask anybody in my home group and they'll tell you. I learn about myself all the time doing service. Even stuff like this, it's like I was so scared. But what's so great was I knew if I get up here and I start running my mouth, I'm going to be okay, you know, because at some point God takes over, you know. And I learned that only by doing it. You know, I can learn this kind of stuff only by walking through it and only by having faith. And you guys can tell me stuff and point me in the direction. But where I take faith is when I just do it, you know. I don't wait for the feeling to come because it never does. I just have to walk through it. And service work has taught me that. And let's see. And then I got to date a lot. Like, that was kind of fun. And I've realized that dating is kind of cool because I also learn a lot about myself and I learn a lot about my character defects. I mean, I remember being told that when I came in, like, you want to learn what all your character defects are? Just get into a relationship. So I've had a lot of experience learning about my character defects. But you know what? I'm really grateful because I, 3 years ago, a little over 3 years ago, I met this like absolutely fantastic man named Paul. Yay, over there. Do you remember being single, ladies? Maybe you get this now. Did you ever have anybody like say that thing to you, like when you're going through stuff and you're working on yourself, or you just broke up with somebody like again or whatever, and you have somebody being like, and somewhere somebody is working, wait, God is working on your Prince Charming. Did you ever hear this? Right? Such a load of crap. I'm like, this is some urban legend that they just tell desperate single women so that we continue to grow and change, you know, like in between. But what was funny with finally meeting Paul was that it really felt like that. Like, once I started to get to know Paul, it really felt like all this like stuff I had learned in all these other relationships were preparing me for him, because I learned how to lighten up, and I learned how to let go, and that I don't have to be so controlling and so clingy, or I don't have to be so distant, or I don't have to be so any of those things. And I'm so grateful for that experience, because I really do think that I met Paul exactly when I was ready to meet him, because he celebrated 20 years in January, and he got sober in Atlanta. We went to the same high school, we realized, for like a whole year. Now, remember, I wasn't sober and he was, which might have had something to do with why we didn't meet. But it was like he came out of nowhere. We knew so many of the same people. We'd traveled in so many of the same circles. You know, we all knew who Fairy Terry at the Denny's was, at Twilight Zone Denny's. So all these same things, and we'd never met. I'd never met him. And I really think that I met him when I was supposed to meet him. How cool. So we met and started dating, and then we just got married like 2.5 months ago. How cool is that? Right? And he's like such a gift for me, because he's like one of those extremely naturally nice people. Like, I don't know if you guys know any people like that. Like, if I'm being nice and not thinking of myself, it's because I am taking effort to do that. He does that naturally. It freaks me out. It's like so weird. But what's so cool is, you know, I'm married to somebody who I can respect and look up to, and who keeps me accountable, because he'll pick up the phone and answer it even when he doesn't feel like it, and he talks to people. Any meeting, anywhere, if he needs to stick his hand out, he sticks his hand out, you know? And it just challenges me, because he can't be cooler than me in the relationship, and he can't have a better program. So, no, I'm just kidding. Not really, though, am I? So how cool is that, you know, that I feel so blessed. This last year has felt like just such a huge blessing. It feels like I just busted my butt and done a lot of work, and it's all this cool stuff is happening. And what's cool is it's not like all this cool stuff is happening and I get to like just go awesome and like kick back my heels, you know, because really all this cool stuff happening almost kind of freaks me out a little bit. And I start to realize, like, now that I have really cool things in my life, I'm a little scared to lose them, you know, like that second half. Like, usually I'm scared I'm not going to get what I want. Now I like have all this great stuff and I'm scared I'm going to lose it. So what's my solution for that is remembering that I'm not in charge and that all these cool blessings that come into my life are for me to use, you know, are for me to use. They're all tools. They're all better ways that I can be of help to someone else, which is what it all comes back to. And as long as I keep it in that perspective, I don't get as scared. I know that I'm always going to be okay. I really do. I know that, like, there will be ups and downs and, like, all arounds. And while it never feels like it in the moment, I know that when I walk through it, I'll get to the other side and I'll be grateful. You know, that's what's always happened and that's what you guys have taught me. And we had such a fun wedding. It was so cool. I'll tell you guys this one last weird thing, like, right? So 2 months before I get married, I'm like excited, we're planning this wedding, and it's so cool, really, like at my age, I think, and planning a wedding with some time and some time to think about it, it was like I wanted everything to just be, like, to mean something. Like, I was not, by any stretch, Bridezilla, I don't think. I was Bridezilla, was I? No, okay. But it was like, I was so excited because I was like, I want to have like regular music for our ceremony. Like, I don't want a violin. Like, so like my bridesmaids came down to like Lenny Kravitz, Let Love Rule. I mean, how cool. Like, we got to pick all that kind of stuff. And we wrote our own vows. And that was so much fun because I was thinking about writing our vows as like, you know, like 70 and 71, the 12 and 12s, and it talks about, or the 12 and 12 in the big book, where it talks about like spiritual ideals and like building a spiritual ideal. And it's talking about it in the reference of a sexual inventory, so like that's not really what we're talking about. But it's a great couple of pages for thinking about just spiritual ideals in general and like living up to spiritual ideals. So in writing the vows, it was like that was what it was. It was like, what is the spiritual ideal? I know that like we're not going to live up to these things perfectly all the time, but I have to put it in writing. Like, these are my ideals about marriage. And what's so great is putting that much thought into it, it, like, comes back to haunt me now in a good way. Because he'll do something, and I'll be mad, and then I'll be like, you know, and then I'll remember, like, that I said something about, like, bringing the spirit of forgiveness into all of our disagreements, and I'll be like, dang, you know? I'll be forgiving now. Fine. It's my ideal that I came up with. You know, but I have this cool place to reference back to strive towards. And so anyways, all that planning was fun, right? So 2 months before I get married, here's the weird thing. My freaking hair starts falling out, right? Starts falling out. And I don't mean like a little bit falling out. I mean like clumps of my hair are falling out. Which, if anybody knows me, my hair, it's like mess with anything. Do not mess with my hair. I love my hair. So anyway. So it turns out, like, I just have this weird, freakish reaction to this birth control thing, hormones. Apparently your hormones are what tell your hair to grow or shed or rest or whatever. So my hormones suddenly decided to tell my hair to shed 2 months before my wedding. So hair's falling out. I'm, like, freaking out. It's funny now. Like, it's funny now. But at the time, that was not funny at all. My hair's falling out. I'm like, just, and I don't know what to do because I know it's not like this tragic problem. I mean, there are deaths and people losing jobs. People were getting laid off at my office, you know, while all this was going on. And I'm feeling like a jerk because I'm so upset because my freaking hair's falling out. you know, and I'm like, ugh. And then finally I just like go and I'm like, call on the phone with my sponsor and I'm like breaking down. And it was like I felt bad doing that, but it was like, I'm funny, right? Because I know that the end result is like, trust God and it's all going to be okay. And I think that somehow I can be where I am and skip the part where I feel stuff and just go right to the part where I trust God, and it never seems to work like that. So what I love is, I mean, I got to walk into a women's meeting on a Friday. I called Lynn, as a matter of fact, and said, like, are you coming to the meeting tonight? And I could just share about it. And it's not like I was, you know, I knew that it was going to be okay, but it was like I had to be where I was and walk through it and let people know and just show my ass. I mean, that's what I had to do. That's what I've learned to do in this program. Because that's what helped me finally get to the place where I could trust. It was like when I talked about it, when I just, you know, it was like, okay, then it was going to be okay. And then I could trust God. I mean, that's where I need you guys to get to that place. I will always need people. I will always hear God through you guys. And I don't know that there was this great reason, because I really wanted to find, like, what's the reason why my hair was falling out? What's the divine reason? You know, my sponsor, Kay, who I wish could be here tonight, but she's had some medical issues, so please say a prayer for her. She's doing a lot better. But she always says, all things are in divine order. Which is great sometimes, and there are sometimes I hear that, and it's like nails on a chalkboard. Fine, all things are in divine order. So I always think that that means that I should be privileged to know what divine order is. So I don't always get to know that. And I don't think that I really know why my hair has fallen out, but I do know that we figured out that this guy was going to do my hair, and we were going to have a weave. This is so great. I got to have a weave on my wedding day. I thought this was fantastic. Because my hair is very thin. I mean, if you guys could see it now, it's funny. It's all growing back, which is fantastic, but it's just in this weird, bizarre in-between stage right now. So anyway, I have this weave for my wedding. And what was funny was it was, you know, it started falling out 2 months before. So by the time I'm at my wedding, we're like laughing and joking. I'm getting my weave put in. My roommates drive me crazy making jokes about it. And all of you guys, like almost anybody that was at that wedding knew about my hair. It was not like, and I have to hide my hair and look all great for my wedding. It was mostly like people like you at my wedding. And what I felt on my wedding day was absolutely nothing but outgoing love and support from the people around me. And it was like everybody was rooting for me. You know, it was like everybody was like psyched that my hair looked great and that it all worked out. They were like, well, your hair looks fantastic. This is great. Everybody was in on it with me, which is so different from the way that I'm used to dealing with people, because I'm usually like against you, you know, or thinking that, you know, if I correct you enough, you're going to want to hang out with me, you know? It's not right. What I've learned is that when I show my ass, you know, when I'm honest and I'm vulnerable, people are with me, and that's exactly what this weekend's been like, you know? I was so scared to be up here, but nothing but just absolute love from people, and like, yay, we're so excited, we're going to see you up there. I felt nothing but love and support, and what a great place to be today. I'm so grateful. Thank you guys so much for having me here tonight.